game ain't nearly over, and the hounds are at my door.
All right, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at wioxradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the radio.fm app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
All right. What have you been up to?
I've been working a little bit towards next year, working on firewood, and 2 years from now, too, actually. Cutting some new stuff and splitting what I have blocked. You?
That's good. No, firewood's done. I usually get that done in spring. But pretty much tapped one tree, and it's running a little bit, but it's going to get pretty cold the next week. And as soon as it warms up again, I see 5 or 6 days, I think I'm going to tap.
Yeah?
But I don't see anything in the 10-day forecast, so.
When did you tap last year?
First week in January, I think. But I don't remember. It was in January for sure.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Very variable then, huh?
I guess.
I've been thinking pretty hard about what I'm going to do this year for sap. First year doing it on a new evaporator at the new house, so I got to set it up the way I want it and figure everything out. So that's what I've been keeping in the back of my mind the last couple weeks, is how I'm going to do it and do it once and do it right so I don't have to do it again. So that'll be my next task.
Yeah, I'll get the burn, not this year, but next year for sapwood, white cedar, so we'll see how that burns. Should burn pretty hot and fast. I don't know. Never done it before. Never had a cedar that I cut down and was worth splitting.
Huh.
But these were big ones, so.
Well, I was assuming it would burn hot and fast, but I don't know. I've never even burned any of that in a campfire.
Yeah, I would imagine. So it's pretty light. Pretty light when I was handling it, so. And it was full of ants in the middle. It's probably good they were cut down. Hmm. But, yeah. Hot and fast is what you want. But tonight we're talking about Balsam Fir with Gary Mead. He's on every third Wednesday from Gary Mead Gary. Gary Mead Gallery. How's it going, Gary?
Good. How are you guys?
Okay.
Doing good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's getting into the early runs of the syrup season, but, you know, we got a pretty good old-fashioned winter going this year, and I mean, we're getting some snow, and it's, I was very pleased with actually spring, summer, and fall so far this year. I mean, that stupid rain we had after, you know, Christmas Eve was a little bit obnoxious, but that probably the most obnoxious part of winter we've had so far. It's cold and it's normal, and because, you know, I was raised back when winters were more normal than they were in the past 10 years, but, you know, it's not out of the ordinary to have warm-ups during winter. I can remember one Christmas day, we had a sick cow on the farm, and, oh, God, I might have been 14, maybe 15, and Doc Fairburn, we had a cow that had a problem, and we called him Christmas morning, and he came over to help us out with her, and it was 65, 68 degrees that day. And I remember running from the house to the barn and bare feet. Well, I never put shoes on when I was a kid. I just, you know, unless I had to. But, you know, all summer long I drove the tractor, no shoes. I basically ran around barefoot. But I can remember that one winter. It didn't happen every year, but, you know, we always had winters that were, they were cold and they were hard. And, you know, we had a 3/4 mile road front with a private road out to the main road that didn't get plowed until Eldred Shaver come along, and he was the superintendent of of Middletown, and he said if there's a farm on the end of a road, got to be plowed. So, you know, it was then they started plowing. But snow plow could come up. All we had to do was make a place for them to turn around. That's all they cared about. But anyway, then we had our road plowed, and we could, I mean, there was times we were stuck in our house for 3 days before we'd get out because of these fierce snowstorms with heavy wind. And we had this road. There was fields on either side. And when the wind blew, it drifted. And we had drifts that were, you know, 6-8 feet deep. And we weren't getting through them. And we'd take the tractor and we'd go out and plunge through them. And, you know, that back in the day before the barn cleaners, they were just kind of coming into focus. But, you know, we had to back this manure spreader in the barn. And my brother was on one side, I was on the other. And if we were happy with one another, we would be kind. And if we were angry or upset with one another, we'd try to splash each other as we were throwing it in the wagon. But, you know, most of the time we got along beautifully. But back in those days, it was so cold when we went out. And that's when they come up, you know, years later, they come up with that, the ponds. That, you know, the farmer just run the manure out into a pond, and they had an agitator in the spring where they would mix it up into a kind of like a liquid. Actually, it was liquid nitrogen, basically, and then they would pump it into this barrel spreader and then bring it out and spread it. But, you know, back in the old days, we had to spread every day. And we would leave the barn, and by the time we got to the field to spread it, the chain would freeze fast to the bottom of the manure spreader, and we turned the PTO on to spread the manure, and the chain would break. And now we're out in, you know, 10 below zero, wind's blowing 20 miles an hour, and, you know, we're laying under, you know, having to hand unload this manure and get the wagon empty so we can bring it back to the barn and fix the chain. It wasn't much fun, but we survived it, but, you know, it's different than it is today. There's a lot, we have so many things nowadays that are so much easier, and you know, production-wise. Well, we don't have, I mean, back then we had, I don't know, what, 14 farms in the New Kingston Valley, and now there's two, so, you know. And they got to try to make up for the 12 that are gone because, you know, we consume actually more than we did in those days, and we have less farmers producing it. So, you know, they had to, you know, think of ways to, you know, make a farmer more productive. And but anyway, let's get off that subject and talk about winter is a beautiful time of the year. We've had some great, you know, weather for this whole year so far. I mean, that flood was a little bit wacky, but other than that, I mean, it's normal winter. I mean, it's going to be down into single digits and teens tonight, and, you know, that's what happens. But we got snow cover, and that's awesome because you can go anywhere in the woods now and dig below the snow, and it's not frozen. And people really don't realize, they think, you know, when it gets below zero, the whole earth is frozen. When there's no snow, yes, it is. But snow is an insulator, and it actually keeps the earth warm, and it protects the roots and the new seeds coming up in the spring. And I mean, you can go anywhere out in the woods now and dig, and the soil and the earth is, it's hydrated, and it's soft, and it's pliable. You know, where they plow and salt around the edges of the highways, it's definitely frozen. But, you know, anywhere else it's a snow cover, it's snow is a wonderful thing. I mean, we pretty much take a lot of, you know, our things that are a blessing in our life for granted. And, you know, it might be we need to get back to that and appreciate the things that make us feel good and just to recognize that and pay attention to it. It ain't about money and politics. I mean, that's part of it, but, you know, our main focus should be on nature, everything it provides, and, you know, we have so many wonderful things that, and we got to focus on them, and you know, we got to get out of this negative state of mind that, you know, and stop flinging hate. Well, let's talk about...
Well, I don't really want to talk about that because I can't make snow, Gary.
You can't make snow.
But one place where snow is more wintry or easier to find is really two places in the Catskills. And one is Frost Valley, if I had to think of a place. You know, really because the valley bottom is around 2,100 feet. So yep. If you're in the Claryville area, it seems like snow comes sooner and remains a little later. The other place where people live would be the mountaintop, Tannersville, mm-hmm. in that area. And a place where people don't live, where winter seems to come sometimes in August, is above 3,500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And all these places share one thing in common, except for Frost Valley, is balsam fir.
Right.
And balsam fir, I never saw it growing in the valley bottom at Frost Valley, but... Tannersville, it does. It does come down from the mountain, and there are places down by Elka Park and whatnot where it's solid balsam fir. You feel like you're in the Adirondacks. There's a little place over by Fir Brook on the Willowemoc where there's balsam fir. But this is a tree that is finally adapted to winter.
Mm-hmm.
And because of its shape, because of its foliage. In fact, the ground isn't always moist. In fact, that's why... balsam has waxy foliage and soft.
Yeah.
And that's to keep its moisture in because other trees...
seals it in.
Other trees would dry out and die. That's why deciduous trees get rid of their leaves. But balsam fir doesn't. It's an evergreen. But it's got that waxy cuticles, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
You know, if you're out surviving, I mean, if you want to... you know, you get caught in a snowstorm or something and there's balsam fir, you can make a... you know, get in some kind of a cave and make a bed of balsam fir, and actually when you lay on it, it feels warm because it's insulated.
Well, many of our mountaintops, like
Slide
Mountain, probably were more bald at one time, probably because of naturalists like John Burroughs and others in the 1800s that would literally make a bed of boughs for camping.
Right.
I don't know, I'm just saying that, but I know they slept on boughs back then. They didn't have sleeping bags like they did as, you know, in the 70s or whatever. But, yeah, balsam fir still must have been cold.
Well, boughs, yeah, still. Yeah. But if you're going to do something like that, you take one bough, one lower limb from maybe 25 or 30 trees. You don't, you know, like... cut a tree down and use it to sleep on.
But you got to burn something, man.
Well, there's dead wood in the woods wherever you go, especially on top of the mountain.
Yeah.
I mean, there's old cherries that try to grow there and they don't make it.
Yeah, but the human browse line. Next time you go to any campsite, doesn't matter if you're in a wilderness area or you're not, you always see what I used to call the human browse line where most of that litter's already picked up and stuff.
Well, it's kind of, talking back in the John Burroughs days.
No, today.
There were, yeah. I mean, I'm today, it's, there's a lot of traffic up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sorry to say they don't respect our landscape and they don't respect our wilderness. And, you know, they're up there and they throw garbage down and they just do destructive things. And, you know, we're having to close some of these, you know, beautiful places because of the
you're talking about Blue Hole. Up on the mountain, I'll be honest, most people were pretty good up on the mountain. I did not find that. Most people who camped up there on the Burroughs Range, That we're well prepared, and I think that's because if you're going to make a commitment to go hike for the day,
yeah,
it's a little different than hiking near the road. And I think that where you get those conflicts, recreational conflicts, near the road usually.
Yeah, not that, you know, within a mile or two up, you know, and that's basically, you know, anybody's going to, you know, really into it's going to go 5 miles deep, and you're not going to find a lot of people up there.
No.
But anyway, I harvested some balsam fir logs from Searles Road about 6, 8, maybe years ago, and you know I had a guy up there that, you know, some of them were, you know, his dad planted them, and they were getting crowded, and he was going to expand his pond, and some of them, you know, I mean, they were spruce, there were hemlock, and there were balsam fir. And, you know, he cut them, and he called me. He said, geez, you know, you can have these if you want them. You get them out of here. So I went up, and you know, he let us use his tractor, and we skidded them across the swampy area, and I had Carl Groscher come up with his little picker and bring them to the mill, and I never knew how to market it because, you know, most people that come in the mill, they want hemlock or pine. And you say, well, I got some, you know, 2x out of balsam, and, you know, they don't know what to think. They say, well, I don't know what that is. I'm not sure if I can use it. But, you know, because they didn't understand it. So basically I have these 12 through 16, anywhere from 6 to 12, 14-inch wide planks that I decided, you know, when I moved to New Kingston, this came off of Searles Road, and, you know, I recently just marked the packs.
Are they as strong as pine? I would think not. Is hemlock and pine? Or?
No, they're not. You can use anything you can use for a stud or a rafter, and, you know, once you apply the cross braces and all that to them, it's not going anywhere. And instead of, you know, like with a hemlock, you'd use a 24-inch center, and, you know, with balsam, you'd probably want to use a 16-inch center.
Yeah, if you look at stamped
it's
lumber,
pretty
like
light.
If you bought lumber from Home Depot or whatever, it's going to be stamped. A lot of it says SPF. SPF stands for spruce pine fir. So in that pack of lumber, you could have spruce pine or fir in that 2x4 pack.
It can't be the same, though.
I would think not, but it must pass whatever minimum strength test is required.
Even when I sawed it, it was half the weight of hemlock.
Yeah,
and it's very light and fluffy. But you know,
yeah. But don't people high grade those packs?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So,
but you're looking in the whole pack. You're gonna have some twisted ones and things like that. But
it's like kid eating all the candy and leaving all the peanuts. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the ones that they're picking out are the something that's got stress in it, that's got a twist or a bow, and that could be any one of those.
Oh, sure, yeah. But, I mean, I would imagine balsam fir has got to have less strength than white pine or southern yellow pine.
Probably. I don't know.
Right? You know wood, Gary. I mean, it's got to.
It's very, very light. And it's light in weight. It's light in color. And it's you know, for a wall stud, I would never be afraid to use it for a wall stud. Floor joists, not so much.
Yeah.
You know, rafter, you know, put them a little, you know, instead of 24, put them 16, they'll be fine.
So there's no differentiation between the sapwood and the heartwood or whatever? Is it white throughout? What does it look like?
It's kind of an off-white.
Yeah.
The sapwood, I don't... You know, when I debarked them, they brought them into the mill. There wasn't no more sapwood to it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I mean, it's a very thin layer between the bark, the cambrium, and the sap. I don't think there was a half inch of sap on any of that. And, you know, hemlock even has about an inch, you know, probably an inch of sapwood on it.
Have you ever gotten red cedar
in
your mill for wood?
I've cut some, but not enough to...
I would think that would be strong.
Well, that's super strong. That the sapwood on that, most of the red cedar I ever got was old growth stuff that was, you know, either, you know, somebody come in to me basically as an artist and say, you know, blah, blah, this and that, and, you know, they'd want a fortune for it, and I'd say, well, I'll give you $50 for the load, and if you don't want it, you need to get out of here, because I don't know what I'd use it for. You know, it isn't a production thing, but it's very, unless you're, you know, like, you know, gazebos and bracing and stuff like that and fence posts.
Yeah.
But, you know, any kind of, I mean, if you get a cedar, red cedar around here, 6 inches in diameter, it's probably 125 years old.
Yeah.
They, I mean, the western red cedar, you know, that's a little different. They grow big and they grow a little bit different out there. But
I mean, that could be a show where we just compare local softwoods.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, that would be a, because I think actually the hardest, the strongest, hardest softwood that we have would be red cedar. Second to that would be, well,
larch or hemlock.
Larch is pretty good, but it's hemlock is the that's
strong.
That's a super dude right there.
That's a barn raiser.
I literally I really do. I'm in love with hemlock because it brought us here. I mean, it took us the whole distance and it was abused and misused
wait a second. Those guys, Zadok Pratt, I mean, they did the tanneries. They love it. I mean, I wouldn't say abused. They did the best they had with their technology.
No, that was see, when the tanning industry, because I read that whole book.
Which one?
What's his name, Pratt. Mitch gave it to me, and that's when I finally, because he actually pulled, Prattsville was built with logs from the tannery.
The town was built upon it.
What's that?
Yeah, the town was built upon it as
well. He
as
pulled
Hunter
them out, but, you know, any other place in the mountains here where they did tanning, you know, it was so far back up into the woods, they had no way to get these things out. And, you know, they would, you know, mostly, you know, the people that did it were seasonal. And, you know, they cut the trees down, peeled the bark, and the logs are just left there to rot.
Yeah, I was just writing an article on this, and people beat up on the tanneries. But, you know, we can do that from our place in 2020.
Well,
back then, they had nothing else going on.
There is
you know what I mean? Like, there was no way to, I mean, the amount of hides that people used to use, it was before plastic. I mean, before plastic, leather was the plastic. They made everything out of leather.
Right.
There was no other product. I mean, you're talking about taking stuff for granted. We take plastics for granted. Well, I mean, once plastic showed up.
Well, we take our faucet and our sink for granted.
We take everything for granted.
But we need need to stop doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get up in the morning and I say, geez, I can make toast. I can go to the bathroom and it's clean and I can take a shower. And, and what makes me realize how fortunate I am, I can go up to camp for the weekend and, you know, you're warming up a pot of water on the stove to go clean up, you know, out in the freezing cold. And, you know, it's just in your dishes, you got to warm up. And it's just a harder, but we have it so easy. I mean,
It's unfortunate with hemlock is they're just starting to grow back. A lot of them growing underneath mature oak and hickory, but they're just getting devastated by the scale and the woolly adelgid. I think we would have been looking at hemlock down the road, you know, in the Catskills.
Well, I think that somehow we got caught up on hemlock.
Well, we need to go back to balsam.
It's
so the balsam fir is.
The only way you're going to find it down here in the valleys is somebody planted it, and it will survive. And, you know, these ones that I harvested, or I didn't cut them down. I just went up there and I pulled them out and limbed them and cut the log lengths and whatever. But, you know, basically I got probably 80% balsam, and there were some spruce and some hemlocks and with it. But, you know, this guy's dad, you know, when he was a youngster, planted these things, and you know, I got 16-foot logs that are absolutely beautiful. And it doesn't – I took a pack out the other day because I said, geez, you know, this has been on sticks for 8 years outdoors. And I was wondering if it's weather-resistant, because there's no rot in it anywhere at all. The bugs didn't go into it, and the you know, it seems to be weather resistant, but it's like balsam wood. You know, it's balsam fir, but you know we used to make those little airplanes out of the balsa wood, which is a different tree altogether. But anyway, it's very light, and you know, it's airy, but it's a good insulator, I would think, because of the fact that it has so much air in it. And when you trap air in anything, it's probably got the biggest R value of most of the woods. More denser woods don't have as good an R value because cold can penetrate it. But if it's light and fluffy, that's why, you know, for studs and houses and all that, and the outside walls, they use softwood because it's a better insulator. I mean, you could use white oak, and it'll cost you a small fortune for, you know, using cherry and oak and maple and that, but, you know, it wouldn't insulate as good, and it's harder to work, and it twists. I haven't seen, you know, I must have had, you know, 1,500, 2,000 board feet of this balsam fir, and, you know, most of the time when you saw, you sticker it and it goes out and it air dries, and you know, you usually get at least a 2-3% degrade when you start going through it and pulling stuff out that twisted and warped and you know, just isn't good for anything but, you know, making stickers or something like that. But
if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and tonight's topic is balsam fir with Gary Mead.
Felt the pain. We shall walk
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John tonight. Like we have every third Wednesday, we have Gary Mead from Gary Mead Gallery over in Margaritaville on. We're talking about balsam fir. So balsam fir is pyramidal shape, and the reason is because the pyramid is the best shaped tree for shedding snow. Whereas white pine becomes kind of top-heavy sometimes, and hence breaks branches all the time. And anyone who's climbed a white pine, I dare you to go on the end and bounce.
Not going to work out.
No, not going to work out.
You might hear a snap.
Anybody that has a white pine in their yard, they must notice an abundance of branches on the ground after the winter's over.
Yeah.
That's because of that. The white pines break apart pretty easily.
And once those upper branches of white pine come down, they just kind of sometimes snowball and take the lower branches out.
On the way down,
because you can't stand on a balsam fir branch. Maybe someone out there is like, well, you can't stand on a balsam fir either. It's true. You're not going to find balsam fir really standing too much. They're not very big trees. But the snow, it won't break it. It'll just shed off. And pretty neat tree. Doesn't live that long, though. So its whole deal is it's a shade-tolerant tree, but if it doesn't get some kind of disturbance, it'll get basically outlived by red spruce or cherry. So, and cherry is not, you know, the longest lived tree of the hardwoods, but it's certainly longer lived than maybe balsam fir. So where you find balsam fir is where there's a lot of snow and snow breakage, ice rime, wind. So, you know, a lot of these higher elevations will have balsam fir for that reason. It gets a competitive advantage over these other trees. Another reason is deer. You get above 2,800 feet, you start losing deer. And the reason is because there's just more snow in the upper elevations. And deer, unlike moose, are not as tall. They can't walk through it as well. They burn a lot of energy. And that's another reason why you probably have balsam, because they love balsam fir. If you're thinking about planting balsam fir without deer protection, think again, because they will eat it.
Going to waste a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, you will. That soft foliage is like arborvitae to them, and they'll eat both of those trees. So
yeah, they like cedar too, red and white.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like a delicacy in the wintertime for them.
They like white cedar more, but we don't have white cedar around here, unless it's planted.
Unless it's planted, yeah. I've seen some huge white cedars on people's lawns that...
That's the one I cut down for sapwood in Stone Ridge.
Really?
It grows very well if it's planted here, but naturally, there's two cedars. There's one, northern white cedar in the Adirondacks near swamps, and the other one's Atlantic cedar, right, in Jersey, New Jersey, on the Kittatinny Ridge, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's where they find it. Used to make pencils out of it or something.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It took me a minute to remember that.
Now, as we're on the side here, total tangent. Sure. That's a true cedar, both of those. But red cedar is not.
Juniper.
It's a juniper.
Yep.
Just to confuse the hell out of everyone.
Yeah.
It's kind of like mountain ash. It's not an ash.
It just has ash-shaped leaves.
It's in the Rosaceae family.
Well, how about tulip poplar? It's not a poplar.
Poplar's even worse.
It's a hibiscus.
I mean, that's just, yeah. Poplar is, tulip poplar is in the Magnoliaceae family.
Right, yeah.
And it's a southern tree, really, with that beautiful orange flower. But it has nothing to do with these other trees like, I don't know, aspen, what people call poplar.
Right.
Or what's that creek popple one you call? Which creek is popple. Black willow.
Yeah, black willow, yeah.
Creek popple?
Creek popple. That's what I always, Dick Fairbairn always called it that.
Yeah. That one gets butchered, popple. A lot of people call
it. If he called it willow, I don't think anybody would have bought it. But he had a pallet mill. Actually, cut parts for pallets. And, you know, he would take balsam, any larch, whatever he got, and run it through the mill. And, I mean, they took everything for pallets. It didn't much matter. And, you know, we took some balsam. He was selling it. We built the staircase or the walls, a raised panel on both sides of a staircase out of it because it was 10 cents a board foot. And I mean, the stuff, I mean, it machined up nice and it wasn't, you know, structurally, you know, it wasn't holding anything. It was just paneling. It was all just for, you know, aesthetics more than, you know, any kind of strength. I mean, we just sheathed up the wall with this stuff, and I mean, it cut beautiful and it sanded beautiful. And I think, you know, back in those days, you know, like 45 years ago, I was using Danish oil on everything, and you know, you could use it, you know, you didn't have to have the heat, and you didn't have to spray it. You just brushed it on, wiped it off, and you were done. And it kind of makes it a little bit, made the balsam staircase with the raised panels look more like a hemlock, like a reddish kind of a color. The Danish oil made it look, you know, a little bit different. It's not like a clear coat. It has a kind of an orange tinge to it. And we got done, geez, I mean, some people thought it was cherry, but, you know, most people said, oh, hemlock. And I said, no, we did that out of balsam. And I never kiln dried that. We didn't kiln dry stuff. We stickered it for a couple of months outdoors, all 4/4 and 5/4. And hell, that stuff was light and there was no moisture in it. I mean, we checked it and it air dried down to about, you know, 4, 5, 6% in just a couple of months in the summer. And that was coming green from the sawmill. But, you know, it was $100 a thousand. You know, we bought $50 worth and we had all the wood we needed to, and then some. But it machines up nice and it's easy. And I haven't ever remember. Because some woods you put through the saw, and I don't care, and they come out the other end, and they get stressed, and they twist, and they don't lay flat, and they're flat before you put them through, but somehow they have a problem when you start machining them. I haven't machined a lot of balsam, but everything I ever cut in the mill, like that 1,500 board feet that I got, there none of that twisted or warped. It just lays nice and flat. It don't seem to have much stress. But you know, a tree will get stress if it's grown in a compromising place where it's maybe too rocky. You know, doesn't get enough sun. All these things, you know, maybe the soil isn't just right and it's struggling for nutrients And, you know, you get a tree like that into the mill, and, I mean, I've had logs you saw into them, and we kick them out, and we say, that's firewood. We're just not going to get anything out of it. I mean, it's a round log when you get it. You saw into it, and a piece falls on the table, and it twists right up, and there's no point in even keeping going with this.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, if a tree's struggling with its, you know, the adjacent trees for sunlight, it's going to, I would think, make the grain more gnarly.
Gnarly, and tree is stressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, even in humans, when you're stressed, you don't perform near as well.
I think the most stressed tree, if I had to think of one for wood, would be apple. That is a gnarly tree.
You're right. Actually, coincidentally, I was gifted a plank of apple for Christmas. Someone turned into a coat rack for me. But, of course, it moved and it turned, and so I had to flatten it back out. And I've just finished it last night. I've got it perfectly flat, and I put a coat of poly on it, and overnight it wanted to move again.
Yeah.
If apple were a person, it wasn't kiln dried.
It wasn't. That was part of the gift. But I ended up screwing it to the wall as the coat rack, and I don't think it's going to move anymore. If it does, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like if apple were a person, it'd be a gangster. It is a tough tree. It is. Okay. It is, man. It just, you can't kill it, too. I mean, you can with enough shade, but...
Most huge apples are hollow.
Yeah.
You know, me as an artist, I've done a lot of stuff out of hollow apple, and it doesn't break. I mean, you see this tree. Well, a lot of them are dying now, but you know, if they're not taken care of, and I know a couple of places where, you know, these orchards. I mean, they're 16, 18 inches in diameter, and the trees are standing dead, but they're on property that I can't. You know, go harvest them. So, you know, I just walk through and say, oh, maybe in my next life. But anyway.
Yeah.
But I have done stuff out of hollow apple logs, and you can take a 10-pound sledge, and it's only an inch and a half thick the outside, and hit them, and your sledge will, you know, you better be careful because it'll bounce off and hit you in the head. But, yeah, it bounces. But the interior wood, I had beech nut by far was probably one of the hardest woods to dry. Apple is five times harder than that. You know, I had somebody from Weaver Hollow bring me an apple tree, and I think you sawed it.
Yeah, I cut it. Yeah.
And I put it through the kiln, and when that come out, I had to apologize. I had no idea. This is the first time I dried apple. And it didn't like it. But, you know, after it was kiln dried, he come him and his dad come and they elected to help me. I said, well, you know, maybe we can flatten this out through the planer. And we put it through the planer and it by taking a little bit off it de-stressed it, and, you know, it was usable wood then. But this was kiln dried, so, you know, anything air dried. I'm throwing a quick lesson on air dried, kiln dried. The cells in a piece of wood, in air dried lumber you have live cells. In kiln dried lumber you collapse the cells. And, you know, with the heat and the pressure in the kiln from the heat and the wind velocity in there, the cells dry out and collapse. So now you have fibers and collapsed cells. Air-dried wood, the cells never collapse. They're still what we call live. So if you take a piece of kiln-dried wood and it gets wet, you can dry it out. And you know, just by putting it out in, you know, in the arid temperature inside, and it'll dry right back out. Kiln-dried will, air-dried, the cells will collect the water again and hydrate, and they're a lot harder to most of the time, an air-dried piece, when it gets wet or, you know, has a problem where it's too humid in your house and you turn the heat off for a while, it'll twist and warp. And because the cells are, they get hydrated with water and they push the fibers of the wood in different directions.
They're not as fixed.
Yeah, and it's not a, but that's, you know, a lot of people, I've had it in my barn for 30 years and it's, you know, it's dry. So, well, I know that, but, you know, you should still throw it in the kiln and we'll collapse your cells for you, because what you have right now is live cell stuff. But you can get away with that with some woods. I mean, cherries are forgiving, you know, soft maples forgiving, hickory's unforgiving, white oak, red oak, truly unforgiving. And but I think, and the soft woods, except for white pine, the pine pitch will bleed out of that stuff forever if you don't kiln dry it. And I crystallize the pitch in pine at 165 degrees. And what that means is it has to get above 165 before it'll turn into a liquid again. Balsam fir, I haven't seen any pitch in that.
Yeah.
I've never seen any.
Well, the pitch just seems like it's
pockets.
Mostly on its bark.
Right,
and
yeah.
Resin blisters. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is balsam fir with Gary Mead. I just wanted to bring up for the show, because we only got 7 minutes, any wildlife to speak of, John?
Well, what first comes to mind is snowshoe hare. If you want to go find snowshoe hare in the Catskills, you got to go in higher elevation, and usually you're going to find densities of them in and around balsam fir.
We used to hunt them. My dad had a beagle named Jack, and we used to go up in the Spruceton, way to hell up in the top of the mountain, hunt them, and they were a lot of fun. I haven't hunted them in 40 years, but they're huge rabbits, and, you know, we had Dad always had beagles that he trained to hunt snowshoe rabbit, and this time of year, that's what we did.
Yeah, I ran into one deer hunting this year, and sure enough, it was within 75 to 100 feet of the peak of a balsam-capped mountain.
Yeah.
Sitting on a rock underneath a balsam bough. It was piebald. That's how I could see it. It was changing. I thought it was well hidden, but when it was half white with a brown landscape, I could see it a mile away.
When I was an assistant ranger, you know, we had to camp on slide to make sure no one else was camping out, so got to know the mountain. And around 3 to 5 o'clock during the summertime, the snowshoe hare would come out and nibble on everyone's crumbs that they left behind and stuff. But the other thing that's unique to balsam fir is, and this is really unique, because you only find it in the Catskills where there's a lot of balsam fir on top of the mountains, which would be like the Burroughs Range, particularly Slide and Cornell Mountain, Wittenberg, the Bicknell Thrush, which is, it's so tied into that area that John Burroughs, back in the day, the famous naturalist, actually thought it was uniquely Catskills. It happens to be one of the most southernmost ranges of it. But this is a bird that overwinters in the, I don't know, Caribbean, somewhere down there, neotropical. And then it comes up, you know, to the Catskills and much further north.
Right.
But you would hear it. I'm not going to attempt to do the sound. It sounds like maybe a veery. Maybe. It sounds very similar. But in any case, the birders would come up right before dark, and these people are something, man. I mean, I have to give it to them. They're pretty committed to catching a Bicknells or any unique bird. They would just come up, try to get it captured on their camera, and then they'd head on down the mountain. That's it. So they'd come up. Before I could say anything to them, they're already heading down.
Yeah, that's all they're after.
Oh, here for the Bicknells. That's it. Boom, done. Where'd they go?
Amazing.
Now, I don't know if it's unique to our higher elevations. I assume it is, but also in November. No, another bird I find in the balsams is snow buntings in November when I'm deer hunting. I don't know how long they stick around for. Mike Porter might know. He's been on the show a few times, but you see him flying around.
Yeah,
in the
he knows birds pretty good.
I'm going to say that the Bicknells, literally, you won't find it below. I don't think so. Yeah. Like below the balsam line. I don't know if I've ever heard it. And back then, I was listening for it.
Right, right.
I don't think you ever heard it. Maybe if someone knows, please let us know. But yeah, I don't think I've ever heard it below that 3,500 foot line. I don't know.
That's cool.
I mean, white-throated sparrows you kind of hear, but sometimes you'll hear those down below.
Yeah.
You know, but yep. Mostly on top. I don't know. Anything else?
I have a poem.
Okay. Yeah, we got about 4 minutes.
All right. Well, this won't take that long. This I wrote back in 12/1/2011, 7 o'clock in the morning. And this is basically an ode to craftsmen and people that don't understand their gift. This is called the Addictive Curse Gift. The gift has always been there, I must say, a curse really that has been leading the way, not understanding its full meaning in yesterday's. Someone always around you trying to lead it astray. What did you know, being so young at heart, you would be dealing with this life force called art? I do not expect you all to understand. I do not get it either, but it's my life's demand. You were pushing it away day after day after day. I did try and take another road to see what's there. The addiction so deep, the new road just disappears. Tried leaving it behind at times by running away, ending up back here in this pleasurable, miserable place. There are three perfect words to describe it, though. The gift is the pleasure in one finding oneself, then cursed by all the problems that it can create. The addictive behaviors that always find your fate. The choices you make daily during your life are driven by these three strong life forces, leaving behind sometimes many a days, finding only great comfort in painful details. Been told by many that it must be so great to have such a talent to love and create. Them not seeing the trade-off every day, being pulled into a world with a one-track mind, it's really quite lonely most of the time. Mind and body so busy, loneliness goes on unnoticed. Till suddenly something puts you back on the street in the middle of a crowd. You just want to get away. Just leave me alone by myself and let me create. Expected other partners to help and understand. They would just put their forceful foot down with many demands. Tried real hard to pleasure them in every way. Then, addictive, cursed gift, art shows up to take it away. I have to go along, for the choice is not mine. Being most grateful, my art is so kind. I see many mean people doing many mean things, and it drives me deeper and deeper into my dreams. And after all my years here on earth, I have to say in my defense, it's the only place I can go where I feel perfectly safe. And that's my poem for tonight. And balsam fir. One thing I wanted to ask about the balsam fir. What kind of berries do they? Don't they have
cones?
What?
The cones.
Well, they start out as a berry, or they're just cones.
They're just cones. The only one that has the berries, which are technically cones, is the eastern red cedar.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, which is a weird tree.
And I suppose the red squirrels and gray squirrels and chipmunks will harvest the seeds from them and eat them.
Probably.
Yeah, because I've never broke one open. Actually, the trees that we cut down, I don't remember seeing any kind of pine cones in it. It must have been there. Yeah. I just, you know, when you get busy just doing stuff, you just don't pay attention as much as you should.
Well, that's all time we have in From the Forest, and if you missed the shows on Balsam Fir with Gary Mead, and we didn't mention it, but balsam fir, to me, I know it for its fragrance. If you ever have a chance, go smell balsam fir. All right.
Yeah, a lot of people use them for Christmas trees, bring them in their house. They're absolutely beautiful.
All right, take care.
Peace, everybody. Be nice.
From the forest, his tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway and the
bottle was his friend, and the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase the old man made his way, his ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games, in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps.